Okay, we'll start. I see we don't have as many people as usual. Maybe a bunch of people are already away for Thanksgiving or getting ready for that, but we have to start. I got a number of comments from last week's class, people who are listening later. So, and I do want to pick up on that. I'm sorry that Moshe from Lakewood is not with us. Maybe he'll hear it. He'll hear the tape because I want to start with what I ended or towards the end last time about the showering on Yom Tov because I did some investigation on that. I had mentioned that in the centrist communities, basically, this is regarded as okay. And I said I thought that even in the Haredi communities, this was like a mainstream view. And Moshe said it's not a mainstream view, that it's an unusual view. He mentioned Rabbi Abadi, but he said basically it's not accepted. So I do want to say that I looked into it and he is correct, but it's a little more complicated than that. Let me tell you what I found. And then I was sent some stuff from Dov Weinstein, who's in Israel, who listened to the tape. The first thing is, just by Googling it, the first thing that came up was something from the Chicago Rabbinical Council. It looks like this. You can also Google it, bathing on Yom Tov. And they conclude that, it is okay to shower on Yom Tov because the fact that members of contemporary society are showering daily would place the majority of people into the category of Me'ungim, and it would be considered as a davar hashav l'chol nefesh. And then he says there, so they say there's room for leniency in cases of great discomfort. So if people feel they need to take a shower, they can take a shower. And this is signed by Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz and other people. This is not the same as, these are not the same signatories as the most famous statement of the Chicago Rabbinical Council. If you go to their website, you can see that they came out with a statement about 5 years ago about chametz on Pesach, declaring that all these, cosmetics and things like that, none of them are a chametz problem. That statement was in response to this book that came out for many years by Rabbi Blumenkrantz, who passed away. But in his book, rat poison even was listed in there as being a chametz problem. So that statement from the RCA, which has from the CRC, which has both Rabbi Schwartz and also the Aguda rabbis, got back to, let's say, the classic definition of chametz, namely something that's edible, and cosmetics and makeup and all those sorts of things, deodorant, that they don't count as chametz. But so that's where I began, and then I looked around a little bit, and I found that it was more complicated than I thought. There is a Haredi site. Well, I'll get to Yecheskel. He doesn't actually. I'll get to that. There's a Haredi site called DinOnline, .org, and I found that they actually have two things. One titled "Warm Showers on Yom Tov," and the other "Shower on Yom Tov." And this is only a month separating them. On the article on warm showers of Yom Tov, they explain all the reasons why, is a Rabbi Pfeffer, I don't know who it is, all the reasons why it should be permitted today. But then they conclude that since the poskim haven't yet permitted it, it's hard to issue a blanket leniency. But there's, they said, if for extenuating circumstances, there's room to be lenient. Actually, I take that back. They say that in both of the articles, but the one of them is longer. And he quotes Rabbi Abadi, which is of interest. But then he quotes from Chaim Kanievsky, who said that bathing is not shavah l'chol nefesh. So Chaim Kanievsky wasn't saying that if it's shavah l'chol nefesh, even if shavah l'chol nefesh, you couldn't do it. He said that bathing is not regarded as something, that everyone does on a daily basis. I don't know how. And they reply, this does not seem to be the case for society in general, where daily showering, certainly after 2 days during hot weather, is fairly universal. So I'm not sure how Psak Rav Chaim Kanievsky, which is contradicted, as they say, by the reality, is so binding. But they quote it. They also say that there's room for leniency in the summer if you have 2 days of Yom Tov, etc. So that's a Haredi site. Now, I found also Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, a leading student of Ramosha Feinstein. If you look in the Rivos Ephraim, volume 6, page 300, he says, Mashma de Bizmanenu. He says that in our day, it's mashma that a shower, nikra davar ashava chol adam, v'lefize efshar hitkalech b'yom tov. So he says that you, in his opinion, you can take a shower on Yom Tov because it's shava chol nefesh. However, I saw other sources that say otherwise. Oh, one more thing. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, I found this as well, said that he's quoted at least by saying that he was matir on Simchas Torah, where Shabbos followed Simchas Torah, so that you have Yom Tov, then Simchas Torah, then Shabbos. Now, not everyone accepts this. I found that Rav Soloveitchik did permit it, at least he's quoted as permitting it, and Rav Schachter was also quoted as saying such, but other sources quote them as both of them, Rav Schachter and Rav Soloveitchik, as only permitting lukewarm water, not hot water. And once you don't permit hot water, it means you're not accepting the basic notion that if it's something that everyone does, shava chol nefesh, then it wouldn't be a problem. Finally, Dov Weinstein emailed me two sources. One is Rav Yitzchak Yosef, who says that you can shower with hot water as long as the boiler already has hot water in it on Yom Tov, you can take a hot shower on it. And he also cite quoted to me Rabbi Eliezer Molamed. Eliezer Molamed is a he's a rav in the city in the Yeshiva Har Bracha. He has many volumes of halachic works called Panini Halacha. I was shocked when last year I read that there was a party, a big celebration, because I believe that it was in celebration of selling 500,000, maybe it was 1 million, but I think it was 500,000 copies of the Panini Halacha, which is an excellent book on practical halacha. And I could not believe it. I said 500,000. Whoever heard, who, when has a sefer in history ever sold 500,000? Maybe the Stone Chumash and their Siddurim, but a halacha sefer in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, maybe in 100 years would have sold that much. So I couldn't understand it. So I wrote to some people in Israel, and they told me that his Sfarim, the Panini Halacha, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it, is now the standard Kitzur Shulchan Aruch for the Dati Leumi community, and all students in Dati Leumi schools or I should say all students, but it's a standard textbook in the Dati Leumi schools that all the students are supposed to buy it, and they learn halacha out of it. So if that's the case, if all the religious Zionist kids are using that as their standard textbook, then I could see how you'd reach 500,000. And he also says that, but again, he's not a Haredi posek. Moshe from Lakewood was correct that the Haredi poskim. It seems pretty uniformly do not permit it. Okay, I'll get to one more thing before we start. Yecheskel says in the Dirshu Mishneh Berurah, they quote Rav Nissim Karelitz, that this is a gezeira. The problem is that if you look at all the sources, they're pretty clear. Even Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he doesn't say it's a gezeira. He says that it's not shava l'chol nefesh today. And I saw some people that said it's not so terrible. You can go without, but a shower. So maybe for 2 days. But if you're dealing with a 3-day Yom Tov, that becomes problematic. Okay, everyone, let's return to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. The last thing I said, and we'll pick up right there, and we have all sorts of interesting things today. I hope to get to it, especially Yechesko is with us. I know you're going to find it interesting because I get into the whole Porush story of what happened with Rav Kook with a number of sources. I have, the last thing I said was that Ravisher Zalman, he escapes over the border, makes it to Kletsk, and he's not teaching anymore. It's Revaren Cutler's yeshiva, but he would give shiurim, he'd speak to the students. There is a man in Israel, I think he's passed away by now, his name was Moshe, I'm not sure, in Hebrew they pronounce it's written Chiger. In English it's Chigier. He went to South Africa, and Moshe Chigier, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, and he wrote an autobiography. I saw that it appeared in Hebrew as well, but originally it's in English. And tells his life story from as a youth in Eastern Europe till South Africa till Eretz Yisrael, and in pages 41 and on, he tells about when he went to Kletsk, the yeshiva. He speaks about Ravisher Zalman Meltzer being there, and he tells the following story that while he was learning in Kletsk, he read in one of the newspapers that Rav Kook opened up a new yeshiva, which is Merkaz HaRav. It's called the Rav Kook's Universal Yeshiva. The official name is not Merkaz HaRav. The official name is HaYeshiva HaMerkazit, but it's becomes known as Merkaz HaRav, even the website. Everyone knows it as Merkaz. So he saw that Rav Kook opened up this yeshiva, and then he wanted students from the diaspora. And Moshe Chigier says that his mind, he kept thinking about Eretz Yisrael. He had a great desire to go to Eretz Yisrael. And hold on a second. He kept thinking about Eretz Yisrael. Put away that phone so it doesn't disturb us. And that he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. So he went to Ravisher Zalman Meltzer. He says, I went to Ravisher Zalman. I told him that I would like to go to Palestine with him, because by the end of 1924, he tells us that it was known that Ravisher Zalman had already accepted this position at the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, so he was going to go. So they said he wanted to go with him, and he explained to him though that he didn't want to go to his yeshiva. That wasn't a yeshiva, Eitz Chaim, for people from Kutz Aretz. It was a yeshiva. No one went to the Eitz Chaim yeshiva from Kutz Aretz. Let me just mention this because it's worth noting. Eitz Chaim Yeshiva was a yeshiva just for like the old yeshuv. There was a forged document that was published a couple of years ago under the name of David Ketter, in which he tells all sorts of stories that he claims to have heard. And he claims to have been someone who went in the 1940s to the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. If you know what I'm referring to, fine. If you don't, it's also fine. But it's a forged document that created a bit of a scandal in America. I could tell people offline what I'm talking about. But just among all the craziness in there was it that an American guy would be going to study in the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. But he told him he wants to go to Rav Kook's yeshiva. And he says that Ravisher Zalman enthusiastically agreed and even wrote a letter to Rav Kook for him. He added on to the letter words to the letter that Chigier wrote, and then he received a reply that he'd been accepted and he's going to go to the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva. However, when he tells then he continues with the story, when it became known in the yeshiva that he was going to Eretz Yisrael to study in Rav Kook's yeshiva, Rabbi Cutler became furious. He called me and strongly scolded me for my venture. When he saw that I was adamant, it says he goes on and he said, he's very upset that this is an act of rebellion, disobedience. I don't think it's so much going to Rav Kook's yeshiva, but that he would decide to leave the yeshiva and go without asking Rav Aaron Cutler. He simply told me I had no place in his yeshiva anymore. He expelled him from the yeshiva. But the Almighty had not forsaken me. When Rabbi Meltzer heard of the situation, he offered me to stay in his house till I go to Eretz Yisrael. So basically, the story is Rav Aaron Cutler expels the student for wanting to leave the yeshiva and going to Eretz Yisrael. It's unclear whether, as I said, it's the disobedience of making this decision on his own without consulting Rosh Yeshiva, or if it's going to Eretz Yisrael without permission, or if it's going to Rav Kook's yeshiva. But of interest to us is that here he is, he's expelled from the yeshiva, and he says, where would I go? How would I find food to eat? But the Almighty had not forsaken me. He's expelled from the yeshiva by Rav Aharon, and Rav Aharon's father-in-law, Rav Isher Zalman, brings him in, and he stays there. At the same time he was staying there, Rav Shach and his wife were also staying in the house. Now that I was provided with board and lodgings, I could manage without the allowance which Rabbi Cutler had withheld from me, and I could continue planning on how to get to Israel. So an interesting tale there of father-in-law and son-in-law. Okay, as I said, Rav Isher Zalman, although Chigir says that it was the end of 24 there, Rav Isher Zalman accepted the position to go to Eitz Chaim, which is true. It's only in 1925 that he goes there. Now this yeshiva, the Eitz Chaim yeshiva, is a very old yeshiva in Jerusalem. It goes back until 1841. And it would have been the only yeshiva, I believe, at that time for the Ashkenazim. It was founded by Rav Shmuel Salant, who was chief rabbi of for the Ashkenazim in Jerusalem, as we've spoken many times in these classes. The chief rabbis for the Ashkenazim were always brought from the diaspora. There's a big problem, which we've spoken about. Why is it that a community that was completely devoted to Torah study, namely Jerusalem, they were supported by the Chalukah system, they never were able to produce the same level Torah scholars as in the diaspora. And I told you about the theory of Menachem Friedman that he develops, that in order to achieve greatness, not just Torah greatness, any type of greatness, you need to be in a society that values that. You need to be in a society in which there's room to become part of an elite, where you have room to strive to achieve greatness. Whereas, you know, there's the average person, and then there's people who strive above this, and they become part of an elite, a yeshiva student. But when you're in a society where everyone just gets up and goes to learn, there's no motivation. There's nothing pushing you to achieve greatness. That's how he explains it. In this yeshiva, the Eitz Chaim yeshiva, you started as a kid, and you could stay there for many years. You could even stay there your whole life. It was that sort of institution. Now, Rav Isher Zalman had a great love of Eretz Yisrael, as did pretty much all the Lithuanian rabbis. Pretty much all the Lithuanian rabbis wanted to go to the land of Israel. And the ones who didn't go, it was because they had responsibilities at home. Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, towards the end of his life, he wanted to go, and they said, "You can't leave. You know, we need you here in the diaspora, the Chafetz Chaim." This is a common theme. But now that he had lost his position in Slutsk, he had a chance to go. As I mentioned last week, when he got married, he took some of his wedding money and he bought property in Hadera, already intending then to go. So he goes to Eretz Yisrael. He immediately becomes one of the important rabbis there. This was, it is Jerusalem, but it still was a small community of Rabbanim, a community that was split between the more extreme segments and the people in Rav Kook's corner, which we'll talk about later today. Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer immediately becomes part of the old yeshuv. They were both the old yeshuv, but the old yeshuv that was in Rav Kook's corner. The Eitz Chaim yeshiva was one of the yeshivas, as the Me'ashar yeshiva and others, which were in Rav Kook's corner in the great dispute we'll speak about. There was another important figure at the Eitz Chaim yeshiva named Rav Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky, Rav Aryeh Levin, the famous tzaddik of Jerusalem. He taught at the Eitz Chaim yeshiva. So this is, as I said, very much a part of the old yeshiva, but also very much in Rav Kook's corner. While he was there, he continues his scholarship as well, and he publishes in 1929, sorry, 1928, and the second volume appears in 1929. The first he publishes the Navalei, the Chidushim of the Ramban, Nachmanides on the Talmud. I'm hoping some people listening now, both live and in addition, those, the many more who listen to the tapes, will consider coming with us to Spain this summer. It's such a wonderful, interesting trip. One of the places we go to is Girona, which is not far from Barcelona, and we walk the very streets that the Ramban Nachmanides walked in Barcelona. We're in the square, and we see the royal palace where the famous debates between the Ramban and Pablo Cristiani in front of the king took place, and we speak a great deal about Nachmanides, the Ramban, such an important figure. In addition to his Torah commentary, which is standard and it's in the Mikros Gadolos, and everyone has to study that, He also published Chidushim on the Talmud, and these were cited by other figures, but they had not come out in a nice edition based on the manuscript. What we knew about the Ramban is that material was quoted in Rishonim and also in the Shita Mekubetzet, but we didn't actually have the text itself. He got a hold of the Oxford manuscript, and Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer did something that usually Gedolei Yisrael don't do. If you go to Masada Rav Kook, Machon Yerushalayim, you have many great editions of texts, and they're put out by very fine, impressive Talmidei Chachamim, but we don't have Gedolei Yisrael doing that. However, here's a case where Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer, one of the greatest Rosh Yeshiva and Torah sages, he took the effort of going through the manuscript, transcribing it, adding his notes. And that was the standard edition for a number of decades. It is not anymore. There's new editions that have been put out. If I'm not mistaken, it's the Masada Rav Kook put out the Ramban. So we don't really use the edition of Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer anymore. The new editions are based on a number of manuscripts. I still would say, however, that it's worthwhile if you study the Ramban, at least looking at Rav Isher Zalman, because he has notes. Most of the notes are just deal with textual problems, and I've seen that sometimes where he said that there's a mistake and it should be some written a different word, that other manuscripts support what he said, but occasionally he puts in comments that deal with the substance of the matter. So Rabbi Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, though, does get credit for being the first one to make a modern edition of the Chidushim of the Ramban. The work which Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer is most known for, and which remains a standard text in yeshivas today, and it's really a classic 20th century work of study of the Talmud and of Maimonides, is called the Evan Ha'azel. The last words of that are sometimes the people say Evan Ha'ezel, but it's really should be in the pasuk. It's Evan Ha'azel. Grammatically, though, it might be work as Ezel because it's not the end of a pasuk, but we usually say Evan Hazel, and that's Aleph Zayin Lamed stands for Isser Zalman. These are Chidushim on the Mishneh Torah in the classic yeshiva way, where you don't just deal with the Mishneh Torah, you bring in the entire Talmud. In the introduction to one of the volumes, volume three, he has a whole paragraph here where he thanks his Rebbetzin, HaRabbanit, and he mentions her name, Bela Hinda. Why is he thanking her? Well, it's very nice to thank her, but he says that she has a chelek gadol, a very large share, in not just this volume, but in the volumes one and two also. Because first of all, she watched out, she kept my health in check. She kept away from me all the, tirdot chitzoniot, all the difficulties. So all the work of this book, he says, these books are upon her. And then something which many rabbis could say about their wives, but he goes even further. He says that she encouraged me in printing it, and she took away all the difficulties. She got the money, hasagat haksafim. She got the money to publish it. The Gam Hetika Bichtav Yada et Kol, he said that she copied in her hand everything I wrote in order to give it to the Lidfus. And she was involved in all aspects of printing and of distributing. Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer's wife is famous as a learned woman. Here he doesn't talk about her great learning, he just says that she copied from his handwriting into a clearer print that was then given to the printer would then set the type. But she is also known as a very wise woman and a learned woman. And I don't think you could give it to any woman who didn't, or any man for that matter, if they weren't learned just to copy the text. Because certain words, it won't be clear what they are. I gave a thing twice, Sfarim blog posts, where it's clear that someone had no clue what they were copying, and weird words show up in modern day Sfarim. There's even one thing where someone added that the author added in brackets that he must have been looking over his original, the text that was handed back to him by the copyist, and said that, to delete this. So what happens? The text appears with these words, "to delete this," in the actual final version. So you need to have someone who understands a bit. But let me just give you one example. And there are many, many stories, but I don't like quoting stories if I can. I like quoting things that I find in print about Ravisher Zalman Meltzer's life. I found this. How'd I find it? I found it because I'm preparing right now the classes after we finish with Ravisher Zalman. We're going to deal with another one of the great sages of Jerusalem who lives at the exact same time as Ravisher Zalman and very close with him. And that's, here you see his picture, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. And so in one of the books about him, Shirat Hayam, on page 543, it has the following story, where Rav Charlap's volume of responsa is known as Beit Zavul. And when it was sent to Ravisher Zalman Meltzer, the story is that there was a people came to his house. Let's see, there was a gathering for Rav Charlap, and a number of rabbanim were there, and his wife was there, and she was bringing food out for the people. And Ravisher Zalman says to her, says Beit Zvul, Beit Zvul. Where does he get a name like this? It appears somewhere in Tanakh. The rabbis always take names that have a play on their names or the names of their fathers, and things from Tanakh. So he didn't know where it was. So he says, Belahinda, where is this written? And she replies, just like that, it's written in the book of Malachim. So here you have one example of many where she wasn't an expert in Talmud, but she knew Tanakh better than Ravisher Zalman. This story comes from Rav Kulitz, chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And if I would hear that story, and there's other stories of women who are experts in Tanakh. How does Rosh Yeshiva, he's focusing on Talmud. He's not really focusing on Tanakh. So you have a very learned woman like Belahinda, who every night is maybe reviewing a perek or two in Tanakh. You can see that she'd be more learned than her husband in Tanakh, and nothing to be ashamed about. Ravisher Zalman, we have plenty of stories. He's very proud of the fact that his wife knew things he didn't know. Well, what I find interesting, however, is that Rav Kulitz wasn't able to accept what I just told you, that Ravisher Zalman Meltzer didn't know, and he really was asking his wife because he didn't know where it was. It's a pasuk in Nach that he didn't know. I mean, he had a memory. He reminded him. He knew it was somewhere in Nach, but he wasn't sure where. Rav Kulitz said it's impossible. He certainly knew it. How did he know it? Because this comes from the Haftarah, Parshas Pekudei. But then why did he ask his wife? He wanted to show all the other people, the rabbis who were there, Ketzad Chayav Adam Mechabed Ishto, how you're supposed to honor your wife, as the sages say that you should honor her more than yourself. This I find quite strange, and I don't accept it at all, because I showing the how is that honoring your wife? Showing all the other rabbis that your wife knows has a good knowledge of Nach. I don't really see how that's honoring her. When they say honor her, they mean to treat her well. That's sort of showing off. Second of all, how could he be sure that she'd know where it was? Maybe she wouldn't know where it was. And just because it's in the Haftarah in Pekudei, fine. I would say that's why Ravisher Zalman knew it was a pasuk in Tanakh, because he heard it in the Haftarah. If it was some unusual pasuk in Iyov, he might not know it at all. I don't like Rav Kulitz trying to take away from Belahinda and saying that the only reason Ravisher Zalman Meltzer, it's like she's a performer here, that it's almost like Vashti, bring her out to perform, that he's going to try to show her off. I don't think that's it at all. And we have many stories of her knowledge of Nach, and it's not an insult to a great rabbi that he doesn't know a pasuk in the book of Malachim. So as I said, I'm not very happy. I'll take Rav Kolitz's story, but his interpretation of the story that Rav Zalman Meltzer really knew it, but he just wanted to show off his wife, that I don't accept. I'll get to the questions and comments later. He also says something else, which I found noteworthy in the introduction to the Eben HaZal. Remember who Rav Zalman is? Volozhin, student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, adherent of the analytic approach, the Brisker approach. Therefore, it's noteworthy that in the introduction, he talks about the Brisker method. I found also that this introduction appears in English translation, this section, and of all places, I get books sent to me for free now by Urim Publishers. And very, very nice books. I've even told Urim Publishers that they wanted me to put together some of my blog posts and make a couple little books out of them. Not big books, little books. So we're taking all of my posts dealing with Rav Kook. And I want to do new stuff on Rav Kook, which haven't been on posts. And we're going to put them in. That's the first project. Hopefully, I'm on sabbatical next semester. I'll be able to have time to do that. So that's my next project to put. We'll publish with Urim a nice little book on Rav Kook, and then maybe we'll do some others. Well, so what did I get a couple months ago? I got this book, which is an English translation. It's called Moadei Harav. Public Lectures on the Festivals by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik by Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Pick. Shlomo Pick is involved, I don't, he might even be head of the Zekola at Bar Ilan University. Shlomo Pick comes from Hartford, West Hartford, Connecticut. He's a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he's been in Israel for many years. He actually lives in Bnei Brak, of all places, and he's very close to a rabbi. A very learned and interesting rabbi named Saraya Deblitsky. Maybe the name means something to you. He's also a Makubo in Bnei Brak. He doesn't have a beard, and yet he's regarded as one of the greatest rabbis and scholars in the Haredi world. And Shlomo Pick is, I think he's the gabbai of Saraya Deblitsky's shul. So he published a Hebrew volume a few years back on Rav Soloveitchik's insights into the Chagim. And here is a translation of it. Anyone who is interested in Rav Soloveitchik will want to see this. And in the introduction, discussing with how Rav Soloveitchik looked at the sugyos, he points out that Rav Soloveitchik also was interested in how the Rambam understood the Talmudic passage, and therefore he says that. It's worth quoting Rav Zalman because Rav Zalman Meltzer is like Rav Soloveitchik in that he doesn't always assume that you have to go like a Brisker approach. Shlomo Pick mentions sometimes the Rav just answers a question by saying the Rambam had a different version. What Rav Zalman Meltzer says is that although we follow the approach of our teacher, Reb Chaim, it's impossible to resolve in this matter all the difficulties in the words of the Rambam. And he says that sometimes, although this is a great approach and this is what we follow, not every difficulty in the Rambam can be explained by what we call the analytic approach. Sometimes there's other ways of explaining I saw also that Rav Zevin picks up on this. Rav Zevin has a number of books, as we know, and one of his books deals is Ishim V'Shitot. And in his book, Ishim V'Shitot, he has a chapter on Rav Zalman Meltzer. And in discussing him, he says, he quotes this passage, which I just read from you, and he says that this is almost like a rebellion against the method of the study in the great yeshivas. And he says, Rav Zevin says, it's good that these words of Rav Isher Zalman, namely that not everything can be given some sort of brisker hechira, it's good that this was said dafka from the elder of the Rosh Yeshiva. And he says, it's possible that you can even see this as a bit of a garaka, a bit of a rebuke to the yeshiva students who've gone so far that everything they think has to be looked at in a brisker analytic approach. Okay, let's return to our story now. So Rav Issa Zalman comes to Eretz Yisrael in 1925, and he's there for everything that happens in the year subsequent. And one of the things that happens is that the British begin thinking about pulling out of Eretz Yisrael. This comes as a result, really comes as a result of Jewish. They would have pulled out eventually, but it wouldn't have been to the 60s, probably the same time they pulled out of Africa. But there was, just like with India, you had they forced them out. You had the Irgun, you had the Stern Group, Lehi, and they decide, as we know, to leave. And partition plan is proposed. We spoke about this a number of times, but let me just read you Rav Herzog's recollection. Rav Herzog gave a hesped, a eulogy for Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer after he passed away. There's a lot of good stuff relating to Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer and Rav Kook, but also some stuff with Rav Herzog in this booklet. A booklet came out, the year is 2004, 50 years from the Yorksider of Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. It's called Oz Nidburu. You can see it here. It's not a thick booklet, maybe 70 pages, and you can see it. It's devoted to the friendship of Rav Kook and Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. And they have other stuff in it as well. And so Rav Herzog recalls that what happened when the suggestion about the partition, to partition Palestine, was brought up. Now, the final partition is 47, but there was different proposed partitions before that. I had already told you in a previous class that when this came up, Rav Herzog didn't know whether they could accept it halachically, because then you're agreeing to give up part of the land of Israel. So he writes to Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski, and Rav Chaim Moser says there's no problem, because we're not giving up the land of Israel. They're only offering us part of it. And if we say no, then we're not going to get anything. By saying yes, we're getting part of it. And by us agreeing to get part of it, we're not saying that we don't deserve the other part as well. It's just that they're not ready to give it to us. That makes sense. It's hard to see anyone who would disagree with it. But Rav Herzog was concerned, and he says that there was discussion among the rabbis about this, and he says, "Ami hayiti az neged ha-chalukah." He says, "I was opposed to this." I don't think he's saying he was opposed halachically. He was opposed because it's a strategic thing. They offer you a partition, and but it's not as much as you want. So Herzog's saying that no, we're not going to accept this. This is Eretz Yisrael. This is our land. We need more. This is not good enough for us. So and he says many other people agreed with me, and therefore the suggestion was that we're going to gather a group of rabbis, important rabbis, and balabatim. Rav Herzog says, in my house, and we're going to talk about this matter. And then he tells that suddenly, who comes to me? Rav Herzog, Rav Issa Zalman, and he's shaking, and he comes to me with a request from the depth of his soul. Rav Herzog says, Rav Issa Zalman came to me and says, stop this anti-partition propaganda that you're doing. Why did Rav Issa Zalman say that? Rav Herzog tells us. Rav Issa Zalman says, Davar shelo hayah Yisrael, klomar medina, something which we have not had close to 2,000 years, and now they're offering it before us, even much smaller than we would like. We cannot reject it. It's obvious, shezem min hashamayim. So Rav Herzog quotes this as an example of the great love for Eretz Yisrael and the desire to have a state that is Jews rule other Jews that Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer had. He wasn't prepared to take any chance that maybe that we say no, we won't get anything. Rav Herzog wanted to fight for more things and say, we're not going to accept that. Rav Issa Zalman says, when we have a chance even to have a small state after 2,000 years, please, Rav Herzog, no, let's not reject this. Striking, I think, from Rav Issa Zalman. We all know the story. They offered the partition. The Jewish side accepted it, the Arab side did not accept it. I'm listening, there's in the news, all this talk of, what's going to be, Obama, his last days, the new administration, the 67 lines, all this thing, all this talk, just to get political for 1 minute. It's an amazing concept. In 1967, all these territories were, which were included in the original partition plan for an Arab state for the Palestinians, were in Arab hands. And then they launch a war. And they lose this war. They started the war. Israel actually said to King Hussein, we have no battle with you. We don't want to get involved with this with you. Stay out of it. And King Hussein starts shooting over rockets into Israel. So they start the war. Israel defeats them. Israel takes land. And then what do they want to do? Now they want to do a do-over. That is, with this sort of logic, Israel can't lose. If Israel would have lost the 67 war, that's it. Could have been a new Holocaust, complete destruction. Israel can't lose. The Arabs can fight and lose again and again. And think of this logic. You start a war, you lose, and then you want to have a do-over. You want to go back to the exact same lines that you started the war. So, in other words, losing the war, there are no consequences. And then you could have another war, and you lose it. You go back to the same territory. So, of course, if Israel needs to make a deal because of the Palestinian population for peace, whatever, they'll make the deal. But the notion that the 67 lines, that there's something sacrosanct and that Israel is occupying Palestinian land, if Israel wants to give back the land because they feel it's in their best interest, fine. But Israel's occupying their land, they start a war, they lose the war, and then they want the land back from which they started the war as if there's no consequences. This is an unbelievable concept that you can start a war and assume that if you lose, you still there's no price to be paid. But there was the war, and they the first of their many rejections, and there was rockets falling all over Jerusalem. Rav Yisroel Zalman Meltzer was injured in his leg when a Jordanian bomb fell near his home, so he was a casualty of the war during this time, and actually shortly before that, you have the story. Well, it's not before that. It's before that of the Yalde Tehran that we've spoken about, the children from during the Holocaust who had made it to Iran, and then they'd brought to the Eretz Yisrael, and the question was where were they be placed? And the religious parties, and Rav Herzog led the way on that, insisted that religious kids, that is, kids from religious homes, have to be placed with religious families. The problem was that the people who were running the Palestinian Jewish community at that time didn't always listen to that. And they were so annoyed at Rav Herzog because Rav Herzog did something that Zionists really never do, in that he also took his voice not just in the land of Israel, but to Jews outside the land of Israel. He let his voice be known that the pressure should be brought on the Palestine Zionist leadership from Jews all over the world. We don't today we like to say that usually people in Israel like to say that if you don't live in Israel, you shouldn't get involved in these disputes. But that was a big issue, and I don't think anyone would have a problem when they have these disputes over drafting yeshiva boys, if the Haredim in Israel go out to the diaspora and try to get pressure from Jews in the diaspora, to pressure Israel. That's not what they did, however. They went to the non-Jews. When they have a protest rally in front of the United Nations or something like that, they're going to the non-Jews. That's something very different. But Rav Herzog brought a lot of pressure upon them, and therefore the Zionist leadership. They decided that, like what did King Henry say? Who will rid me of this meddlesome priest? They said, who will rid us of this meddlesome rabbi? Was that Moore? Thomas More, I forget who he executed, but so they wanted to get rid of Herzog. And after all, why can't they get rid of him? They run the show. But they didn't count on the fact that there'd be a big backlash. And that, let me tell you what Rizal Meltzer had to say about this. Well, remember, the position of chief rabbi of Palestine is a position instituted by the British government. The Sephardic position, Rishon LeZion, precedes the British moving in. But when the British came in, they created a chief rabbinate with a whole court system, and they set it up that it was run by the Jewish community there, the new yeshuv, and the whole system of elections and who gets to vote and everything, the same way it is today, except for now it's done with the state. This was before there was a state. So they wanted to get rid of Rav Herzog. Rav Isher Zalman leads an assault against them for doing this, and it's not just against them for removing Rav Herzog. It's he talks about the whole notion of removing a rabbi from his position. You can see Rav Herzog's, Rav Meltzer's letter in B'derech Chatz Chaim, Volume 2, page 362. Ritzi Pesach Frank signed on it as well. What they wanted to do is they wanted to have new elections. Even Rav Herzog was chief rabbi to push him out. This is exactly what happens today. Rav Zalman Meltzer will be turning over in his grave when you read what I say, because today in the state of Israel, they have elections, and they do kick out chief rabbis if they want. But Rav Zalman says that he quotes the Ramah in Yeridaya that we do not remove rabbis from their positions. Now he says it's true that there's a practice. When you hire a rabbi, and this was the case, he was hired in a limited year. When you first hire a rabbi, you give him, let's say, a 3-year or 5-year contract. And he says, based on that, people have tried to say, well, that means that after the 5 years, you don't need to rehire him. But he says, this is taus gamor. It's a complete mistake, because the Chasam Sofer has already written that that this sort of these years really are for the rabbi himself. It's not for the it gives the rabbi the ability to leave, but not the community. And the Chasam Sofer and many others have written about how if the rabbi is doing a good job, and there's no problems here, you do not get rid of a rabbi. It's his position. And he says we've never heard that you give a rabbi a few year contract that I'm talking he's talking about in Europe that then you get rid of them. So chalila chalila to create such a thing where that rather than malin bakodesh you're going to remove the rabbi and he says there in Israel he says you don't have this practice anyway of rabbis for a few position for a few years and he says and don't tell me about America he says and what about in America the minhag is to choose rabbi a new rabbi so Rav Isher Zalman knew what happened in America that you hire a rabbi for a few years. And then you get rid of him and you get a new rabbi. He says, no. He says, Yadua shezeh hishpil sham kavod harabanut. He says, what they do in America has destroyed the kavod of the rabbinate. He says, but here in Eretz Yisrael, we don't follow these what these other countries do. And he says, Ein shum heter l'shanot harabanim yecheskatam. There is no permission whatsoever to remove a rabbi from his position, and that's how it was with Rav Kook, that's how it was with Rav Herzog. Only later, as we saw with Rav Unterman and Rav Gorin, then the thing changed. So a strong defense from Rav Isher Zalman. Well, Ramosha Feinstein discusses this in his response because I mean you could say all you want that the Chasam Sofer says it, then you can't. But as Ramosha says, when rabbis today are appointed. They take the job al Tanai on the condition knowing that they can be removed. That wouldn't apply to Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog never took it al Tanai. But speaking on the American scene, the rabbis say take their position on condition, and maybe it's not a good thing and it shouldn't be done. The rabbi shouldn't be removed. Chasam Sofer's whole point was you have a rabbi, the rabbi is doing a good job, he served you well. Just because there's someone else who could do a better job, that doesn't give you the right to throw out the rabbi who's doing a good job. If he's doing a bad job, he's not satisfying, then you can get rid of him. But if he's doing a good job, you can't continuously change people to get someone who's doing a better job. It's not like, hire a basketball player to play for your team and then someone's better. You get someone better even though they want to. The Chasam Sofer says this is it's a lack of kavod to the rabbi. I mean, you could look at it the other side. Well, this don't you want to have for the community the best for the community? But no, this is a disgrace to the rabbi. It's a bizayon, we say. It's a degradation of kavod haTorah. And I think that most shuls, let me take that back. The shuls I've been associated with, that's the way they function. They don't try every time there's a new election. If the rabbi is doing an okay job, doing a good job, they're satisfied. They don't try to see what's better, what's out there, just to get rid of the rabbi to see if maybe we can replace. But the Chasam Sofer is very strong. He says that it's a bizayon haTorah. You cannot remove a rabbi from his position just because you think you want to get someone else. The rabbi can leave. Maybe it's the rabbis, they make the rules. So the rabbis say that it's lifetime tenure when you hire them. But Rav Moshe says technically you can if it's part of the contract. But the Chasam Sofer doesn't say that. He doesn't think so. Rav Moshe Zalman, as the senior Rosh Yeshiva, as one of the senior rabbis, was very much involved in the situation in the state at its formation. There was a few big issues. One of them was drafting of yeshiva students. That's an issue that continues to this day. The other was drafting of women for the army, and the third dealt with Shevut Lumi, a compromise measure put forth by the religious Zionists that rather than the women going to the army, they do national service. Something which, on the face of it, seemed even to great rabbis in the religious Zionist camp as not at all problematic and actually a very good thing, but which met with strong rejection by the Chazon Ish and the Haredi leadership. In fact, the rejection of Shevut Leumi, national service, was then and continues to this day just as strong as the rejection of drafting women into the army for reasons I'll talk about in a little bit. I mean, it is a little obscene when you hear about 19-year-old Haredi girls who are working. They won't go to Shevut Leumi, but yet they'll work at that time. They'll work in a non-religious office when they're involved in an environment which is not a religious environment, and yet it's Yahari Velyavar, they say, it's the death penalty if they would actually work with poor children. Now they do. It's obscene, I think, from my perspective and others. The Haredi response is that there is a difference in that when they choose to work. Even if they're working in a non-religious office, it's out of their free will. They come and they go. They can quit when they want. The problem with Shevut Leumi is not the working with the children. It's the fact that you are now subject to a boss, and a boss who's not a Haredi boss, and a boss who is not couldn't maybe could not even be religious. And that's the problem of putting yourself in a framework in which you take orders from someone and you have no choice. At least that's what they claim. But what's the matter? So, Rav Isser Zalman, he met with Ben Gurion three times over these issues. Once concerning Shevut Leumi, he never met with him about the draft. The draft, I mean, this was such an issue that it's not an exaggeration to say that the Haredim would have sent all their young women out of the land of Israel when they turned 18. They would not have allowed them to remain in the land of Israel. The protests were unbelievable, and in those days, no country had a draft for women. America didn't have a draft for women, and even when it's only been very recently that women are allowed in any sort of combat. I think now they can be in airplanes and things like that. But the idea that Israel was going to be drafting women, it made Israel's image look very bad, and a lot of propaganda was put out there that the whole point of drafting the women was to turn, let's say, the army into a brothel, things like that. So it made a terrible impact on Israel's image, and that was fairly easy to win that battle. But Rav Isser Zalman met with him once regarding that. He also met with Ben Gurion. There were two other delegations, and that dealt with the much more problematic matter of Sorry, I take that back. The second time he met with him was about draft-free yeshiva students. That was much more problematic for a number of reasons. First of all, why can't a young man be in the army? Hi, you tell me women can't be in the army. And let's not forget, the Haredi opposition to women in the army was not about Haredi women. They opposed any women going into the army. That was their preference. However, the non-Haredi, the non-religious, and even many of the religious Zionists said, well, we want our daughters to go to the army. So the Haredi position was that, okay, but not our daughters. But they thought that the whole idea of women in the army bichlal at all was wrong. However, what's the issue for yeshiva students? Remember, in 1948, 49, there was no notion that Haredim shouldn't go to the army. That doesn't come until the Begin years. Begin is responsible for the abomination we have today that anyone, by virtue of the fact that they wear a certain outfit and live in a certain neighborhood, shouldn't go to the army. Let there be no mistake about this. For years, the Haredi propaganda was that the reason you should, well, since the Begin's time, the reason the Haredim can't go to the army, yeshiva students can't go to the army is because, they're learning. When all this changed, when the possibility came about of Haredi units and everything, then they changed their tune. And they said what people like me had been saying for years has nothing to do with yeshiva students. Because even when you offer them the possibility of that, they said no. It was all about that it would affect their culture. And they thought it would destroy Haredi culture. And now they're open about it. The Haredi representatives are completely frank about it. They do not ask for exemptions for yeshiva students only. They believe that any Haredi, all Haredim, should be exempt from the draft because the army is a threat to their religious culture, and that you cannot have a Haredi boy go in the army and still come out Haredi. I don't know how many people listening to us now have been aware of this, the change in the propaganda. The Haredi movement no longer argues that it's only a matter about yeshiva students. Their claim is that by definition, anyone in the Haredi world should be exempted from the draft, whether you're in the army or not. And that's really what they always thought. The propaganda about yeshiva students are helping the country by learning all that, and that's why we can't take them, that was always a smokescreen. The real argument was a cultural argument. But in 1948, there were plenty of people who would today we would call them Haredi in the army. There was a very small number of yeshiva students. You're talking in the hundreds. There was no expectation, no assumption, and no demand ever made by the Haredi leadership, by the Chazon Ish, by anyone, that Haredim should not go in the army. The assumption was, of course, they're going to go to the army. What they were asking, however, was, and what they wanted at first were religious units, something we spoke about in the past. What they were asking for, however, was that the yeshiva students, which was a small number of people who to devote themselves exclusively to Torah study, and we're dealing with an elite of people, and we're dealing also after the Holocaust, when yeshiva population had declined a great deal. Because of all the terrible killings during the war, that there was a desire to rebuild up a young cadre of Torah scholars. The idea that you would take these people in those years that they need to devote themselves to Torah study and force them to go into the army and remove them from Torah study, that was something that people like Rav Zalman Meltzer said we have to work against. So let's hold off on, I see it's already 10, so let me take your questions. But we'll talk about this because Haredim fought in the War of Independence. So to make the argument about why they shouldn't be in the army, as we'd say in yeshiva, it's not so pashut. It wasn't so simple. They weren't saying that Haredim couldn't fight. They were making a different claim. And then we'll have to talk about as well the issue of well, other issues. We'll get to that. But let me take your questions, and we'll stop here. Let me go back now. Going back, yes, Jay Kelman tells us that the trip to Spain is a wonderful trip. It's a great trip. It really is a great trip for all who are listening. Spain, especially, it's worth coming with us because kosher food's a problem in Spain, but we have wonderful kosher meals wherever we go, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But it's not so easy to travel around Spain. It's not like you go places and you just forget the food thing. Sites are far away from each other. It's hard to travel by yourself. It's not like in Central Europe where you have all these sites just waiting for you. We take you to great places. We take you Shabbos in Gibraltar. We have a wonderful, wonderful time. So if you can't come, those who are listening, if parents of your friends of yours, please spread the word. It'll be our fourth year. Yeheskel said mentions in dealing with the story I told about Rissa Zalman's wife that the women probably only learned Tanakh. That is the case. That is indeed true. The women did not learn Talmud. But we have women who are experts in Hebrew language who learned Tanakh. The story about Rabbi Weinberg, who taught of the rabbi that taught his daughter Talmud, if I recall, that's Esther Rubinstein. Esther Rubinstein was the wife of the rabbi of Vilna, Yitzhak Rubinstein, whom we've spoken about so much, and her father was a rabbi who Rabbi Weinberg knew. Rabbi Weinberg has an essay on Esther Rubinstein. What a great woman she was. He published it in his work, Lifrakim. And then when Lifrakim was reprinted, for some reason, this essay and some other essays were removed. So when I republished, when I not republished, when I published the collected writings of Rabbi Weinberg, I included this essay on Esther Rubinstein, who is not really a model today for like the Aguda types, because she would speak publicly. But a very interesting woman. The book on Rav Issa Zalman, it's not really a book, it's a booklet. It's called Oz Nidbaru, Yirei Hashem, and it's Kishrei HaYedidut, Bein Maranan VeRabanan, HaGaon Rav Yitzhak Kuk, and HaGaon Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. There are four such booklets. Let me tell you how many pages it's in. That's 50 pages in picture or two. There's a booklet like that about the Rav Yashav's grandfather, of Shlomo Yashav and Rav Kook. There's a booklet on Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Kook, and there's a booklet on Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rav Kook. Yecheskel asks, do you think that the story of Mina of Meltzer would be willing to fight for it once we had it? I'm not sure what you refer to like what we had. Yecheskel says, once we had after 1967, or Rav Zalman Meltzer have said we should return it, so they let us keep what they. Oh, you never know. Who knows post 67? The standard Lithuanian rabbinic approach has been that giving back land, as Rav Soloveitchik said, it's a matter for the army and for the military leaders. That this is not Lubavitcher Rebbe and Tzvi Cook and others said you couldn't give back any land. That hasn't been the standard approach, but you can never speculate. Yechezkel says, speaking of teaching girls Talmud, when I asked Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky if I could teach my daughter Talmud, he told me what refers to the laws about women, you can. I mean, you have in certain more right-wing schools, they will take a page of the Talmud, they'll make a photocopy, and they'll read some lines of that. That's not really the study of Talmud. The study of Talmud, forget having the book, but the study of Talmud is when you look at a sugya. You look at a sugya, we're coming up to Hanukkah. So you look at the argument, you study the argument of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel of what's Mahadrin, what's Mahadrin, Mahadrin. You look at Rashi, you look at Tosfot, you look at, that's the study of Talmud. To simply have a page of Talmud and read a few lines that relate to something about the women. In a Gaddic section, or even a Halachic section, even just take the page and say that, what my Hanukkah, and you read the page, the few lines of the Talmud, what the Gemara says, what is Hanukkah? That's not the study of Talmud. That's not the study of Talmud is to study it, just like the men study it. Incidentally, regarding Hanukkah, it's not mentioned in the Mishnah. If anyone wants a very interesting point. Also, Yecheskel said that Chaim Kanievsky said any sugya. I don't know. Okay, did he mean any sugya of Talmud where you actually analyze it and you look at Rashi and Tosfos and Rishonim? Or did he mean any sugya relevant to women, i.e., you take out the Gemara and you read the lines that relate to women? Hard to say. That's what you understood. Maybe that's correct or maybe it's not correct. I say maybe it's not correct because you have all these books now that come out of things people ask from Chaim Kanievsky. and you have people saying the exact opposite thing. So the problem with Chaim Kanievsky's answers is you never know exactly 100%. You understood, he said, any sugya relating to women. So I'm saying maybe he meant by saying any sugya, you take out a sugya relating to women and you read it. That doesn't mean you read Rishonim. That doesn't mean you look back and forth. It means you read the what it says. Who knows? That's hard. Or maybe he looked at you when he saw that you were more modern. What can I say? I don't know. Okay, everyone. For those in America, as I do every year, I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. If you'll be observing Thanksgiving, we've spoken in the past about rabbinic views on Thanksgiving. Otherwise, if you're not, well, enjoy the days off as well. And we will pick up again next week. Oh, wait a second. Rabbi Kelman is typing something. Let's see before I say goodbye to everyone. Maybe he's not typing to us. Sometimes if you're connected here and you type something else, it shows up at the bottom typing. In any event, good night, everyone. And next week, Yecheskel, I think we'll get to the story that you can lend some of your personal experience as well, the amazing story of the trial of Rav Kook and the execution of Rav Kook by these, what do we call them? These biryonim, these ruffians that we'll speak about. One final thing. No, actually, we're all done. Good night, everyone. See you next week.